Leader Xi Jinping and his local entrusted officials, Chen Zhengguo and others. So we've been saying, these documents confirm. These documents have confirmed what we have been telling the world in the last 2.5 years. But it's incumbent upon the government officials, lawmakers, judges and prosecutors to look into this to see if this is, constitutes crimes against
humanity. We're going to do part
humanity.
Two. Thank you to Nuri Turkel, as well as to Austin Ramsey of The New York Times.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is now 8:02. Up next on Voices from the Edge, Linda Olson Osterlin interviews historian and investigative journalist Andy Worthington on his work on Guantanamo Bay. Listeners are welcome to call in.
Please, we are tired. Even you leave us to die in peace, or either tell the world the truth. Open up the place. Let the world come and visit.
Shaka Armour, last British man in Guantanamo. Stuck in a cell alone, though the US says it wants to let him go. And half the men still held are in the same sad situation. Political games that are to shame the nation. Shackle, shackle, they chain your body, but they cannot chain your mind. You tell truth to power, even though you are behind.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Voices from the Edge. This is excuse me, Linda Olson Osterlin, and you were listening to Andy Worthington and his song about Shakir Amir. Good morning, Andy Worthington.
Hi, Linda. How are you doing?
I'm great to have you on the air again. Let me tell our audience a little bit more about you. Besides being a singer, and I'm not sure that you didn't become a musician just to talk about the politics of Guantanamo, but you do a great job of it, and I encourage people to find your music on YouTube and other venues as well as on your own website. But let's let people know a little bit who you are. In 2013, you were recognized for your work in Guantanamo. You were shortlisted for the prestigious Martha Calhoun Prize for Journalism. And this was because you, of all journalists in the world, took on the job of actually finding out who were these men who went to Guantanamo, how did they get there, what was their story. And you you published the Guantanamo Files, a definitive book on all of these prisoners, and it's been updated through the years. Part of how you were able to update that was you worked with WikiLeaks on some files, some classified military files that exposed the thin veil of why they were holding these men. The pretense that they were the worst of the worst became very clear that they were not when those files were released. So you've done, and yearly you've come to the United States and joined with others here and others from other parts of the world to protest the continued existence of Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and to ask for the release of the men held there, or at least real, honest trials, like, say, in a district court meeting requirements of evidence for those who have not yet had a chance to prove their innocence. So thank you so much for all of your work. I know you're going to be here just tomorrow, I think, you're arriving in the United States.
Yes, that's right, Linda. Thank you very much for that introduction to me and this work that I've been doing for what is now getting on for 14 years. So, that's quite a long amount of time. And I kind of became the custodian of the men's stories, really, through the research that I did, and so I've continued to maintain this interest in who the men are who have been so effectively dehumanized by the United States over three successive presidencies.
Tell our audience, in that vein, tell our audience a little bit more about Shakir Amir and the work that he's done since he has been released.
Well, you know, Shakir was, he's actually been, you know, living a quiet life and trying to reconnect with his family since he was freed from the prison, which was back in October 2015. So he's been out for a little over 4 years, but I did actually see him just yesterday, and he's doing very well.
Yes, so he's doing well, and I know that he has
but
spoken.
You know, he was sorry Linda.
I was just going to say, I know he has spoken out for other prisoners and for the conditions, about the conditions in Guantanamo. Many of the people who come out from Guantanamo are so damaged, it's all about just trying to make life pull together in some way, you know, with family and people that love you. But he was able to take some very strong stands on behalf of others.
Well, I think, and he was fortunate to the extent that he was, he was released back to Britain. I think that for many of the released prisoners, the worst circumstances have been for those men who, for one reason or another, couldn't be sent back to their home countries. And so, because the United States wouldn't take in any prisoner wrongly held at Guantanamo who couldn't be safely returned home, then third countries had to be found that would take them in. And all kinds of deals were cut with these countries. They, involved money, or they involved diplomatic favors. Quite often, the places that people ended up were countries that, didn't have a Muslim population, perhaps didn't actually have a very supportive government, but it was part of the effort to undo the damage that had been caused by the creation of Guantanamo in whatever way the Obama administration, which did most of this, could actually do. And we're still only hearing bits about these stories now, Linda. A lot of the stories we don't really know, of people who were stranded in an unknown and not necessarily very supportive country, all because the United States wouldn't take responsibility for the mistakes that it made.
I mean, yes, you know, I think Obama, we actually have a clip of Rumsfeld being sort of grabbed at an event by a reporter and asked some questions about the justification for opening Guantanamo. Let's take people back to, it was January 11th, 2002, when Guantanamo...
Right, the opening day.
Yeah, that's when they started transferring prisoners that they had collected from, I believe, Afghanistan at that time, prisoners who were being sold by Pakistanis as they fled the country when the bombing started. And and they were just sold. They could be students. They could be almost anything. And according to statistics and information found out since then, the overwhelming majority of them had nothing to do with fighting against the United States or the Taliban or Abu or any of the different things that we want to say that they did. But let's listen to that clip from Rumsfeld. Yep, here it comes.
This subject was discussed.
Secretary, you mentioned this morning that it would be terribly dangerous to blur the distinction between lawful combatants and unlawful combatants, but could you help us understand what legal entity, organism, international or otherwise, does make that distinction, if not the Geneva Convention, between unlawful and lawful combatants?
There is a definition of what a lawful combatant is, and there are four or five criteria that people look to historically. There's precedent for this, and there is a reasonable understanding of what an unlawful combatant is. And the characteristics of the individuals that have been captured is that they are unlawful combatants, not lawful combatants. That is why they're characterized as detainees and not prisoners of war. The Al-Qaeda are so obviously a part of a terrorist network, as opposed to being part of an army. They didn't go around with uniforms, with their weapons in public display, with insignia, and behave in a manner that an army behaves in. They went around like terrorists, and that's a very different thing. And it's important for people to recognize that this is a different circumstance, the war on terrorism. It requires a different template and in our thinking, and all of the normal ways that we think about things simply don't work. For example, there were no armies or navies or air forces for us to go after in Afghanistan. We're going after terrorists, and that means you have to go and find them and root them out and stop them from killing people.
That was Rumsfeld back in 2002 trying to justify the basis for Guantanamo and for putting combatants in Guantanamo as calling them not real combatants. You know, it's interesting, this whole language about terrorism, because now he's defining it by did you wear a uniform or not, but the U.S. government is defining Soleimani from Iran as a terrorist when he was a high-level person with uniforms.
Well, I think it's probably a sign of how much that original mutation and abuse of the language back in 2002 has infected everything ever since, really, Linda. I mean, you know, it's quite chilling listening to Rumsfeld so casually describe people who, if they had done anything, were involved in crimes, which is what terrorism is, being dismissed as being able to be held according to the Geneva Conventions and having their rights stripped from them.
Well, and he complains that they didn't have any big weapons to go after. Doesn't that sound very strange? Gee, they're not a big enough, you know what I mean? It's like, and
yeah,
it also reminds me of Vietnam, where, of course, the quote, guerrilla tactics were much. Any tactic that a side uses that has trouble for U.S. military becomes something named something else.
Well, it becomes asymmetrical warfare, and
right.
Then, you know, I think this, for the war on terror, was when, you know, you heard Rumsfeld there, he dismissed the notion that this army, that, you know, that soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, who were Afghan soldiers, and in some cases were supported by people who had come from Arab countries, that they weren't soldiers at all, that all of them were terrorists, which is an absolutely absurd thing to conclude from the original basis that they weren't behaving like, you know, like Western armies who arrayed themselves in uniform up against each other.
Well, it also allows you to arrest anybody and call them a terrorist,
yeah,
which
and
they did.
And not to screen them, which, of course, is what they did at Guantanamo, yes, where they contemptuously disregarded any valid screening process, said up front that everybody they captured was an enemy combatant who could be held without rights, and didn't bother to find out whether they were right or wrong. And, you know, that's an appalling and irresponsible way to behave, and it's poisoned everything ever since. That, you know, in a lot of ways, they've never really known who they captured, because they didn't care.
Well, they didn't want to know if it proved them wrong. How many, it was at 752 is the number that were, you know, at the highest number that they had held there?
The U.S. military, according to its own figures, held 779 men over the last 18 years. And there are just 40 of those still there.
And there's 40 of them still there. Some of those they're planning to keep indefinitely. They've already said they're planned to. Five, I think, have been released for, they've been cleared for release, but they've not any place to be released to. And there's been no releases since, is it 2013?
Well, no. I mean, Obama released a lot of prisoners, especially towards the end of his presidency.
Okay.
Donald Trump has only released one man. So in the last 3 years, just one man has been released. He's been sent to continued imprisonment in Saudi Arabia. He was only released because he agreed to a plea deal as part of the prosecution proceedings against him at Guantanamo, the military commissions. And Trump had to honor that. And you know that if it had been, if he didn't have to, I'm sure that he had to be strong-armed into it. I'm sure he had officials saying, you have to honor this.
Right.
So he's
otherwise,
in a person.
Yes.
I mean, otherwise, the official policy on Guantanamo is what Trump tweeted 2 weeks before his inauguration. There must be no more releases from Guantanamo. And that's it. There is no legal mechanism to compel him to release anyone. He's holding, like you said, five men who are approved for release by high, unanimously approved for release by high-level government review processes under Obama. They didn't get out before Obama left office. He doesn't want to release them. Nobody can make him. There is no legal recourse that these men have to demand their release.
And they're
and
sitting there
else,
in what's called indefinite detention, not ever knowing if they'll ever get out, if they'll ever see a family member again. And
yeah,
the U.S. Supreme Court recently, not ruling on Guantanamo, but ruling on asylum seekers to the United States who were put in detention, ruled that they could be held indefinitely, that there's nothing to stop the U.S. from holding someone who's just coming and seeking asylum in our country in a detention center. By the way, these are profit-making, big profit-making detention centers on our southern border and on other places. And so it seems like we've gone backwards, that the Supreme Court has in some way said the rule of law, habeas corpus, does not apply in these cases, that people can be held with no proof and no crime and no conviction. So that puts us in an even more difficult situation than we were when this started. Not real hopeful for us. We are grateful, I am anyway, grateful for all of those who have been able to get out of Guantanamo, but we still have it sitting there. And I think it served to normalize behaviors that 13 years ago, 10 years ago would not have been accepted. I do want to open the phone lines, though, because I know we have our audience out there who would like to get in and talk about this as well. And I invite you to talk about how does this in your mind relate to what's been going on with Iran, with all of the latest stuff happening in the Middle East. How do you think what happens in Guantanamo matters about that, or the existence of Guantanamo matters? And how about yourselves out there, audience? Have you thought of Guantanamo in the last year? I hate to say this, but I have to make myself remember to think about it in the flurry of catastrophic news we're having every day.
Yeah.
It's very hard, and yet we're coming around to another anniversary, and I don't believe in giving up on this kind of thing. You know, eventually the Angola three men who had been locked for in solitary for the longest was up to 42 years in Angola prison in Georgia, did eventually all get out. Two of them are out and living. And so I don't believe in giving up on these cases. If people gave up, that wouldn't be so. So we're not going to give up. I know you're not going to give up, Andy, and I'm not going to give up. We hope the audience...
Well, no, that principle, you know, that principle, Linda, as we've seen with the case that you're talking about with an asylum seeker, which, you know, that needs... People need to focus on that. They need to look into what's happening there. But, you know, it isn't implausible to suggest that the only reason that kind of thing could happen is because the precedent exists at Guantanamo of holding people indefinitely without charge or trial. Now, before 9/11...
And people who we've been made to think are dangerous, invading our country, or the dangerousness of them has been presented to us as invading our country, and they've been called all sorts of vile names by the president, et cetera. So they're not, you know... They've been made to be the worst of the worst.
Without charge or trial is the behavior of a dictatorship,
yes.
Not of a country that claims to respect the rule of law. And, you know, if that's what the United States government wants, then it should be honest, but it's not. It's pretending to be one thing while doing another. There is no excuse for indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial in a country that claims to respect the rule of law. It's simply not possible.
I do think, however, more and more... with our current Supreme Court and with our parties in play, that they don't really care about the rule of law. I don't think they really care about the Constitution, and that does not sound, that's not happy talk over here, but I think we have to face, a law isn't a law if you can't get it enforced.
No, exactly. I think that it's very, very troubling indeed.
Yeah. You have your own sets of these things going on, different and similar in Britain as well. I know it's not been easy time on your side of the pond. Is that what they say, on your side of the pond? I think I've heard that in movies something. I don't know. I want to let the phone number out there so people can call in and talk about Guantanamo. It's 503-231-8187. That's the phone to the air room. Asia is there, happy to answer the phone and get you on air. We do really want to hear what you have to say about this. Don't get too discouraged to even talk about it. I know there are people out there. I know a friend of mine who has fasted with the people in Guantanamo before, and I know there's many of you out there who very much care that this is going on. So please give us a call, 503-231-8187. We've got lots more to tell you, the events that are going to be happening in Washington, D.C., etc. I did want to talk about that. It was interesting that there was a bill passed, a $738 billion defense bill is passed, and the headline I'm reading here says Guantanamo prisoners are ignored by Congress. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, that was my article about the sad conclusion of the wrangling between the House and the Senate over the annual insanely expensive National Defense Bill, the National Defense Authorization Act. I mean, just for a second, let's all just think about $738 billion. This is the U.S.'s annual war budget.
Well, and you know, Andy, since I've first spoken to you, the streets of our city of Portland have changed. When I first started talking to you, there were a few areas where you would see campers sleeping on the street. Now it's all of Portland. It's all over Portland, except for certain neighborhoods where they sweep them more frequently. But really, truly, in any direction I could travel from central Portland, that you're going to see streets covered, even in this cold, cold winter, and with new shelters opening, covered with people in tents. And we still hear on the news every night that we're having our greatest economy ever. For someone who's seen streets with very few people out of housing to streets filled with them, and to in our city we have something between 18,000 and 20,000 empty housing units that are very, very expensive and were built just on speculation. So $738 billion, what could that do for the people on the streets in my city and in Los Angeles and in San Jose and, you know, Salem, our little town down here? And this kind of poverty on our streets, this kind of disregard for humanity, brings out some mean people. You know, some of the people on city councils and on city government get mean and decide that the best thing to do is just keep forcing these people to not be in our downtown so that our business does well.
And as part of this insane amount of money, obviously a small part of the picture is Guantanamo, and as we learned last year at one point, it was publicized by Carol Rosenberg in the New York Times, it costs $13 million a year. I actually worked it out, it's $14 million myself, but who's quibbling? $13 to $14 million to hold each of those 40 men at Guantanamo, because the total cost of running Guantanamo is over £500 million a year.
Wow.
Just for that one prison facility, you know, which is so many, 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 many times what it costs to keep a prisoner in a maximum security prison, even on the U.S. mainland. An absolutely extraordinary waste of money maintaining this pointless and abusive prison at Guantanamo Bay. So, you know, and in the NDAA, there was nothing specifically authorized to add on to the situation that we've had for years. But unfortunately, as far as the Congress is concerned, their purpose is to every year impose the same restrictions on the president, preventing him from bringing any prisoner to the United States mainland for any reason, whether for medical treatment, which he can't get at Guantanamo, or to be put on trial, prohibiting the president from using any funds to move, to create a new facility on the U.S. mainland where prisoners could be moved from Guantanamo so it could be closed, prohibiting them from closing the prison and from handing anything back to Cuba. Everything is just a status quo of maintaining the horrible and unjustifiable presence of Guantanamo year after year, endlessly.
Many of the prisoners are over 50, have illnesses, yeah. Have illnesses caused by, I think I read about one whose knees are bad because of them chaining and shackling his legs for so many years. And
yeah,
so,
well, everybody there is either literally getting old, or if they're, you know, younger than us, they've been through such a horrible time, they're also suffering from ailments. And it's very expensive. Everything at Guantanamo has to be brought in from the United States mainland. It's very expensive, and for some medical conditions, they can't really bring in the equipment. They need to be allowed to take somebody to a better equipped hospital, which would be on the U.S. mainland. But this prohibition every year stays in place. And actually, over the course of this year, when the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee were coming up with their versions of the bill, one thing that they both seemed to agree on at one point was that prisoners should be allowed, in cases of extreme medical urgency, to be moved to the U.S. mainland. It didn't make it into the final bill.
Yeah, they don't want to do that at all. They want to use it as the example. You know, at the same time, as many have pointed out, that the existence of Guantanamo helps grow the numbers of terrorists who hate us. I believe the United States military likes it to be there as this is still what could happen to you.
Well, absolutely.
And that $13 million a prisoner, I mean, it becomes such an absurd and even surreal world where we, you know, we'll go to such extents to provide medical care there rather than just resettle somebody, you know, just resettle them with their family. It's the cruelty and the meanness and the fascisticness of it that is so disturbing to us at this time.
I would say the racism on the part of Donald Trump.
Right, the racism as well as who these people are.
He does not want any of these Muslim men released under any circumstances. They cannot. There is no mechanism by which they can be freed from that prison unless the president and perhaps Congress agrees. Primarily, they're prisoners held at the whim of the president of the United States. He seems happy for this situation to carry on. Unless we get a significant change of leadership, what we're looking at, Linda, is that these men will remain in Guantanamo, all of them, cleared for release or not, will remain in Guantanamo until they die. Now, this could be 10 years, it could be 20, it could
be 30. For some of them, it's already happened. There have been some suicides.
There have. But, you know, some of those men in Guantanamo are around 40 now. Theoretically, they could live to a ripe old age. Perhaps somehow their will to live, you know, remains. And And the United States as a whole is apparently prepared to keep spending $500 million a year, more than that, keeping open this prison for this dwindling number of men forever.
Well, and I believe that you mentioned her name earlier, Carol Rosenberg wrote about that they had been preparing an area on Guantanamo, on the Guantanamo Bay, not on the base. They've been preparing an area to hold a 13,000, they called it, I think, a climate refugees. So it would be okay. Like immigrant, like a giant camp. And so they probably have plans to continue and increase the amount of prison they have there. I had a couple questions I wanted to ask you about that. In terms of, as far as you know, are there still secret prisons being used by the U.S. military, using other countries, using other places to be holding people that they're pulling out of different situations, say Somalia or any of the other situations where we're going into militarily supposedly fighting Al-Qaeda or ISIS?
Not that I know of. And, you know, there may be something, there won't be a major program. I think the thing that people need to be aware of is that if the United States is engaged in overt or covert combat in any of the many countries around the world that the United States is involved in, when people are apprehended, there is that time between them being apprehended and it being decided what is going to happen to them, which I think mostly these days is probably returning them to their home governments if they're from authoritarian countries, who will then deal with them. There's a very gray area about how they're going to be treated, and there's a problem with the Army Field Manual in that it allows for those kind of torture techniques to be used at the discretion of commanding officers, which seems to have been kept in there as a way of allowing a certain amount of carte blanche in the way that people are treated immediately after capture.
Despite Obama saying we won't do any of these things anymore.
Yeah. Saying we don't torture. And it's like, okay, well, maybe you don't have the torture prisons, but you haven't definitively prohibited torture. But then,
apparently we set up drone bases all over the world so that we can assassinate on command.
Well, that was Obama's big innovation. We're having a problem apprehending people and dealing with how we treat them. So what about if we just assassinate them instead?
And
the logic of that has just been revealed this week in the Trump has taken it to, I think, an extreme in assassinating, you know, an extremely significant individual of a country that the United States is not at war with.
Well, say someone assassinated General Mattis or Pompeo or, you know, pick your favorite military or, you know, right wing. If someone assassinated those from a foreign country, we would do much more than what Iran has done. There used to be something, and this is really, it is kind of odd because you don't hear it anymore except when it's wanting to be applied in strange ways. There used to be a concept called national sovereignty, and all of the nations that came together in the United Nations or other such governing bodies were said to come together as sovereign nations, meaning they had the right to manage their own internal government policies without interference from external sources, because it was recognized that they were sovereign into themselves. And now it seems we rarely talk about that, and we just sort of knee-jerk, of course, expect that sovereignty for the United States and don't seem to expect it at all for other nations, because what are all of these drone bases if not breaches of sovereignty? Though I do believe one of Hillary Clinton's greatest accomplishments in the Obama administration was helping set up these, getting permission and getting them in place, getting the drone bases put out there. She traveled more than any other Secretary of State.
Right. But a lot of the time what's happening, of course, is that nothing is based on these foreign countries. Drones are flown in from the United States or from some other location that the U.S. has.
Yeah, though we do have some small bases in places in Africa that we just don't talk about. I know the main ones are more like Djibouti.
Which would be used as a launching pad. But, you know, in Iraq, where the United States is no longer the conquering power,
Well, I believe we've been asked to leave, haven't we?
A man was assassinated who was Iranian. The U.S. is not at war with Iran. I mean, every aspect of this story
is wrong. Makes it illegal, violation of international law.
Well, exactly what you were talking about. All international borders and sovereignty disappeared. And when did that happen? It happened after 9/11, when the United States declared a war on terrorism, which recognized no boundaries. It was global. That's what they said. One of the reasons the men are still held at Guantanamo is because efforts to prove in a court that the war in which context they were captured, which was actually something to do with Afghanistan nearly 20 years ago, was over. And, you know, in every practical sense, the war that led to their capture, the toppling of the Taliban and the decimation of al-Qaeda, took place quite shortly after the 9/11 attacks, in 2002, maybe into 2003. Whenever they go to a court, the judges say, no, the war isn't over. The war goes on forever. President Obama declared an end of active hostilities in Afghanistan at one point. So lawyers went to the court, and the judges said, the president doesn't get to decide whether this is true or not. There is no end to the conflict. The conflict is international.
Right, and it
recognizes no borders. Nobody is safe.
And yes, exactly. Nobody is safe, and it is intended to go on forever. I want to throw that number out again. If you're listening and you would like to comment on this conversation, please do give us a call. 503-231-8187. We'd like to hear from you. You know, this is KBOO. It's a community radio station, and your input is important. What you think, what you care about. You know, we want to hear it because it's part of what we're addressing. We're often called preaching to the choir, and I say, well, the choir needs preaching to, and I include myself in that. So you have information for us as well, and you have your point of view. Please do give us a call, 503-231-8187. You know, when I was doing some research for this today, Andy, I came, and I'm speaking with Andy Worthington, author of Guantanamo Files and one of the main activists fighting to have Guantanamo Bay have the people in there released or tried for general release. And he comes to the U.S. every year at about this time because on the 11th it will be 18 years since Guantanamo Bay was open and there are 40 men still locked there. But while I was looking into this, Andy, I came across there's a U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit is going to hear it was arguments were going to be heard on December 11th, and I didn't hear what happened as a result of those arguments, but it was going to be in a case called Abdul Razak Ali versus Trump, and the central question is whether the due process clause applies to limit the length of detention at Guantanamo Bay. Ali, who's been in there 17 years, argues that the Constitution's due process clause does apply to Guantanamo. The D.C. Circuit precedent does not foreclose the application of due process clause here, and Ali's continued detention violates due process. The 2001 authorization for use of military force limits continuing detention at Guantanamo is another point of. So those are the allegations that Razak Ali is making to get himself removed from Guantanamo, or actually to be able to have due process applied. I assume that would mean having his detention questioned and be able to question the basis of it. The judges are Judith Rogers, Patricia Millett, and Raymond Randolph, and they're hearing the arguments, and then several friends of the court also submitted amicus briefs. They came from Human Rights First, and they explain why the Guantanamo Bay Review Board is not valid. So anyway, that to me sounds like there's a court case that might have something benefit come out of that. Have you heard much about this?
Well, it's interesting that you should raise it. Hardly anyone's mentioned it. It's quite legally complex, I think, for lay people to understand. But, you know, it's one of a number of approaches that are being taken where lawyers are trying to find ways to put pressure on the administration to allow a kind of meaningful review of the prisoners' detention. You know, because they were given habeas corpus rights by the Supreme Court in 2008. In the years that followed that, several dozen men were released from the prison after judges said that the United States didn't have a case against them. And then appeals court judges in Washington, D.C. changed the rules in a number of rulings ending up with what they basically said was everything the government says must be regarded as presumptively accurate unless the prisoners can prove otherwise. So these men with no access to anything are supposed to rebut allegations.
Right, kind of the opposite of proven innocent until guilty.
Yeah. I mean, it was terrible. And as a result, no one since then has been able to get out of Guantanamo through having a habeas petition granted. And every year, lawyers come up with ways to try and get the Supreme Court to revisit these rulings, to reassert their authority, because actually what's happened now is that prisoners are held at Guantanamo because of the appeals court, not because of what the Supreme Court initially decided, which was that the men had habeas corpus rights. So, you know, it's a hugely complicated story in a lot of ways. But what it really comes down to is finding a way to challenge this notion of endless imprisonment and this notion that the current processes that are in place are somehow legitimate. And for the men who are being held forever at Guantanamo, there's a group of, not the ones already approved for release but still held, not the ones facing trials, the 26 others, the forever prisoners, as the media helpfully called them a few years ago, they have a parole-type review process that was set up by President Obama to review their cases. And under Obama, in the last few years that he was president, these parole-type processes led to recommendations for the release of over 36 men, and all but two of them were released before he left office. And he did that really to bypass the Republicans' restrictions on him releasing prisoners. He said, let's not make this about guilt or innocence. Let's make this a parole-type thing where they have They express contrition regardless of whether they did what they're accused of or not, and to give us coherent plans for their life after Guantanamo, and we'll release them. And that was a good way of him to release all these people. But the process is continuing under Trump, but it's become completely meaningless because the commander-in-chief doesn't want anyone released. So guess what? The review process has not found anyone to be approvable for release. And the prisoners have realized this, and they're now boycotting it.
Well,
so if you ask the Trump administration, they'll say there's a robust review process for the prisoners at Guantanamo. They won't tell you that it's being boycotted by the prisoners because they have realized it is a total sham.
And this lawsuit is intended to see if they can get the courts to say that this needs to be changed as well.
Exactly.
We do have someone on the phone. We do have a caller. Andy, so let's let her on the line.
Yeah.
I didn't catch your name. Caller, are you there?
I am.
Hi. What's your name?
Hello, my name is Edie.
Thanks, Edie.
May 1982, I was working for a man who was working for NATO. And I asked him, you know, what he did that day. He says, it's been an ongoing project. It's not just today. I was mapping all the known petroleum and methane reserves in the world. And I asked, oh, why? He looked at me like I'd suddenly gone way down his estimation. Before that, he thought I had intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I couldn't believe I was so stupid. And I'm not used to people looking at me like that. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, because all the wars are about resources, primarily about water and oil, and it takes a lot of time to prepare for wars. it takes years in advance. I said, okay, then what wars are you preparing for or something? And he told me every war the United States and NATO would be involved in for the next several decades. And he told me where they would be and when they would start. And we had every war officially. I mean, we've done a lot, pre-Epstein war, but every war officially started on the week that he said they would, except for the one against Venezuela for their oil.
They're still having trouble with that one, aren't they?
Well, Russia stopped them two times. And one time... a weapon didn't hit the area that they had planned. But I had been a very patriotic, trusting, naive Republican. And it was during these travels when I'm with people who had been, their families had for 850 years been ruling Europe and the world that was ruled by Europe. And they were telling me about how grotesque things really are. One woman I was working for in Holland had me read The Ugly American. But so when I would hear the buildup, oh, so-and-so's bad, and the vilifying, as if one individual, an entire highly populated country, is slandered or libeled, therefore we have an excuse to murder millions? And I would see this buildup and shock that how could Americans think that that's an excuse for war? And I would see how they would practice different excuses. Bush Sr., Herbert Walker Bush, said, well, we could, you know, would you go for war for this? No, for that. It was only, oh, to start weapons of mass destruction was the finally one in which they could, the peace movement, to stand down.
Edie, let me ask you a question. Don't you think it's wearing a little thin? I mean, do you think even the Republicans believe what they're saying about Soleimani and that kind of thing? I mean, Soleimani was a legitimate government leader of a government that we are opposed to, but he wasn't what they're making up. It seems like nowadays it's wearing very thin. And
my whole life I've been wondering, well, why are people mean and dishonest? I don't get it. And a book that I was recently told to read, something like Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And I can't remember the author's name, but it was all this research on self-deception for self-justification, mm-hmm. that we want to believe we are right, so we will ignore all the facts otherwise. We will distort and change our memory to come up with convoluted things. And the more guilty and shameful and afraid we are because we've done more horrific things, the more we vilify the victims and become more rigidly opposed to science or facts or law or justice or human decency or whatever it is. And I don't want to ever have me go down that way. And I'm struggling if it is about domestic violence or racism or environmental destruction. I've been telling people for over half a century we're ruining the climate, and people I noticed their responses were dismissal of me, tune it out, don't hear it, call me a liar or crazy, instead of them be feeling, caring, honest people who have a moral obligation to act with justice. And so I'm
well, Edie, I think this is really an excellent point you're making, because I think what's really important is some research that's been done on people who are dissenting from the norm, you know, dissenting in their views and their outlook and speaking about it. And it's been pretty widely found that most people don't like dissenters. They will identify that they don't want to be around them. They don't like people. They don't want to be described as that themselves. However, their views do change. So they studied it, and they, you know, when you put people with people who have a dissenting view, it's harder for your own view to change. We actually all have a bias for our already own beliefs, but we do change when presented with dissent. And so, it, you know, for those of us who seem to see things somewhat differently than the norm or what the mainstream is allowing out there, it's good to remember that even when we walk away from that wondering if it made any difference or if there was any purpose for saying those words, you do make a difference with your words. So,
and that's my personal commitment, is to do the prayer for myself and for others, open their minds to be receptive to truth and justice. But I think also we need to let people know the incredible inner peace and joy and self-respect and self-trust and liberating energy and inner calm that comes from integrity. When we are seeking truth and we're humble enough to change our thinking and behavior to align with truth and with kindness and fairness, it helps our immune system.
Yeah.
It helps us discover things we hadn't learned. It makes us immune to peer pressure.
Well, you know, one other thing I think
power that it's contagious, and that people say, "Wow, you have a balance, you have a joy, you have a vitality, you have an intelligence, you have a joy. What is it?" And well,
I think I find the other thing that makes people feel really satisfied is taking action on behalf of those beliefs they have. So one of
that's
the things,
because otherwise it's not truth, love, or integrity.
Yeah.
If we have truth, love, and principle, we act on it in the individual, with our thinking, in our interpersonal relationships, and in society.
Well, and I'm thinking right now about Guantanamo. I'm thinking like on the 11th of the anniversary event of Guantanamo, and I would like to see everyone in our listening audience take a moment to send a quick email or put a quick call into your congressional representative or your senators and tell them, remember Guantanamo, fight for Guantanamo.
Yeah. Ironically, this January is also internationally the month of human trafficking awareness,
mm-hmm.
and it was the human trafficking of innocent civilians to promote the warmongering profiteers that had these folks end up at Guantanamo.
Well,
we can connect the dots, because when we allow those people to be trafficked and stuck, and we allow those at the southern border to be trafficked or trapped, we are empowering and enriching that whole system that puts the rest of us
right. So let's say Saturday on the 11th, let's ask everybody to be, and Friday's a good day because your senators and congressmen are actually around, and most of them are being at Washington, D.C. right now, so you can call the congressional hotline, and you can Google that very easily or call information to get it, and call your own representative and say, take a stand for Guantanamo. We know there are people going to rally on Saturday out there. Join them. Stand with the people of Guantanamo and for the rule of law, because standing for Guantanamo at this stage really does mean standing for the rule of law. I'm going to let you go, Edie. And
wherever they go.
Yeah. I'm going to let you go, Edie. We have another caller, and I do want to get to Andy, I want to have you be able to tell us the activities that you'll be taking part of here in the United States. But let's get our caller on really quickly. Arthur, did you say? Albert? Hello, Albert.
Yes, I have a little problem that with your statement that Soleimani was a legitimate man. I'm from the country that Soleimani is from.
Uh-huh.
These people are horrible, horrible people. You just see it from outside. You don't see it inside the country. This man was a loser. He was a high school, barely high school educated, maybe not. And he was vicious. He was from the organization called SEPAH. This mm-hmm. this organization is an army that protects only the government, not the people. They had absolutely nothing to do with the people. They executed a lot of people with the leadership of this man, this vicious man. And believe it, you guys cannot believe it because you think it's not true.
Well, actually,
but
what I think is that we don't know the truth from not living in there, but I do believe that our own military is what I was trying to compare him to, is
yes,
our own
yes,
military,
the
and the assassination of one of our military leaders would be considered horrible.
It would be considered an act of war, wouldn't it? I'm not supporting the action of the military. But being against the action doesn't mean that guy was a nice guy. These guys,
no, absolutely
in
no.
Iran, they raped the kids, the girls, before they execute mm-hmm. them, because they truly believe if the girl was virgin and they execute him, he goes to heaven. So they raped. Do you dealing with these kind of people? How could you defend and say that this guy was illegitimate? I agree with you. The way they killed him. was bad. There were no war, but it doesn't mean that guy was illegitimate. It doesn't mean that guy was a...
But I don't think that anyone was saying that he was a good person. It was just that the process for killing him was not the correct way of doing things. I mean, that's my understanding.
Yes.
Well, and I don't think that we have the right to kill generals of other countries or military leaders of other countries. And I don't think... If I said good guy, I didn't mean to say good guy. I don't know if he's good or bad. What I know is he's a leader of a foreign country.
Then as a radio representative, you have to study it. Go study
yes.
to see what kind of guy it was.
All right.
And then come here at the public radio, say, okay, this guy was this, or he was the best man, but he wasn't. People are suffering under these people.
Well, Albert, thank you for calling in with that information, with your information about Soleiman. And certainly I do need to do more more investigation into him before I would talk about him more. But we do have one other caller on the line, and we just have 30 seconds, so I'm going to go to that caller.
Oh, am I on air?
Yes, you're on now.
Yeah.
Your name is...
Yeah, my name is Arthur.
Hi, Arthur.
Hey, quick comment. My background, conceptually, is my father was in an army. My brother was in the Air Force for 30 years, and I am completely anti-war at every level.
Okay.
Having grown up in a traumatic background, warfare is a bad thing. So it's not just Trump that makes that you're talking about Guantanamo Bay. You got 30 seconds, I know. It's not just Trump that runs Guantanamo Bay. There are thousands of individuals that partake in this terror.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
state
I'm going to take my comment off the air, but that's all I want to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, Andy, we've only got a few minutes, and we want to know what's going to be happening in your comments about any of the rest of this, but also what's going to be happening this year here, Saturday and through this next period of time that you're here.
Well, there's the annual rally involving a number of different groups, Amnesty International, Center for Constitutional Rights, Witness Against Torture, many other groups.
CARE from...
Close Guantanamo, which I run outside the White House. That's at 1 o'clock on Saturday, the 11th. I'm doing a panel discussion with the attorney, Tom Wilner, who I set up the Close Guantanamo campaign with 8 years ago. We're at the New America Think Tank. That's also in Washington, D.C. That's on Monday lunchtime at 1:30. Then I'll be back in New York. I'm trying to line up an event in New York, and I'm also hoping to do other media stuff, Linda, with people like you who I've been talking to for many years, who understands the importance of Guantanamo. So that's the story, really.
I'll try to spread this out on my... I rarely use Facebook anymore because of the difficulties both I've had, and I was one of those Cambridge Analytical people that got, targeted, and I just really don't like it. But it's one of the few ways to publicize events and stuff like this. So I will, I'll press on to share our show today and share events. Is there a place I can find an event page where I can link to?
I think if people go to closeguantanamo.org, then they'll be able to find the list there of things that are happening. And that's also where I've got the poster where I'm asking people if they want to show their support for the campaign to close Guantanamo to visit the website and the Gitmo clock page that we've got, which counts in real time how long Guantanamo's been open. And we've got a poster there which shows that on Saturday, the 18 years is actually 6,575 days. And it's a poster that people can take a photo with, holding that up, pointing out how long it's been, telling Donald Trump to close it. And we do these every 100 days and then on special occasions like this throughout the year, asking people to show their support, that they haven't forgotten, that the things that are being done in their name are not things that they approve of.
I'm going to see if I can get that done this year. I've failed technically a couple times, but but I'm a little bit technically backward. It's not hard to do. You just have to print out the poster and do it. So I thank you so much for joining me today, Andy Worthington. Your work around Guantanamo is recognized and very important, and will continue to be important as our society is rapidly changing, not in directions that look really good for us. We still need every one of us. We all have a role to play, and certainly you do. Thank you so much, and I'll keep
it. I think is that
go ahead.
People can make a difference.
Yes, every one of us does. We have the opportunity to make a difference with our voices and our actions. And thank you again for joining us on KBOO Voices from the Edge. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund. I want to thank all of you, the listeners. Sorry we didn't get you on a little bit sooner so we could hear more of your comments. It's always important to me. And I want to thank Asia, our board op today, who helped us with all the clips, etc. Thank you again for being part of KBOO Portland. Next up, I believe, is Press Watch.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month we'll screen the documentary Time to Choose on Thursday, January 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Coal contributes to 4 out of the 5 leading causes of death in the United States.
There was actually 6 neighbors who had brain tumors in about a 10-house span.
Again, that's the documentary Time to Choose on Thursday, January 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. For more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Time for Press Watch.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, today I'm going to be joined by Portland Peace and Justice Works' Dan Handelman. Before I get to that, I want to go to a few headlines. For starters, given the fact that we are once again looking at Imperial War, you should know that there are a couple of events associated with that in town. And one of them is at 5 p.m. at the Gibbs Street Pedestrian